Got grubs? Maybe some midges? It's insect day on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry. Today, perhaps you've seen some of these Asian needle ants around. Ticks? Well, they're around too. And fortunately for us, we have entomologist PJ Leash with us for the next 90 minutes to help answer all of your insect questions. Whether they're in your garden or invading your home, what do you want to know about the insects around us? You can join our conversation at any time by calling us at 1-800-642-1234, and I hope you do. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can always send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And PJ, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
It's great to be here.
I saw you on the Madison's local ABC affiliate a little more than a week ago talking about what Anya Van Wagenendonk at WPR News has called the mystery of the Mother's Day midge hatch of 2025. Also got a write-up in our local paper. Was Madison the only place we saw the swarms of midges?
No, although Madison area did have a very intense bout of midge activity. In general, midges, which we also call lake flies, these are delicate little flies. They will resemble mosquitoes in terms of their appearance, but they don't have that elongated tubular biting mouth part like a mosquito. So they're really quite harmless. But with midges, just about anywhere you have water, that could be a lake, a pond, a marshy area, a stream, you'll have midges in the state. So you can find them across Wisconsin, but sometimes in a given spot, you can have very intense localized activity. So that's what we've seen recently here in Madison, and that's really not unheard of. I will say I've been in the Madison area close to 20 years now, and I do recall some springs in May in particular, right around that time of Mother's Day, give or take, where there were just huge swarms of these adult midges, where if you see them from a distance, it looks like someone's having a campfire
yes.
out on Picnic Point or somewhere else. Just these massive clouds. If you're close, you hear the buzzing noise. But it's not unique to Madison. I've also had a lot of reports of recent activity from Milwaukee area, close to the lakefront. And I get reports from that part of the state almost every year. And actually, on a worldwide basis, Lake Winnebago is famous for their midge or lake fly activity. If you go to areas such as Oshkosh, Appleton, Neenah area, at various times in the year, you can get very intense localized activity of these midges. And when they come out for a given species, the adults are short-lived, but they tend to be present for maybe about two-ish weeks, give or take. So it's very much a short-term, fleeting, ephemeral thing, and then they disappear for a while.
I am glad you're here, and I am clearly not an entomologist because I was calling them mayflies. It was May, they were flies, therefore to me, they were mayflies.
But yeah, you know, you're not the only one that's called them mayflies,
okay.
And I totally understand that. It's the month of May, they're flying around. Mayflies have a similar story. They're aquatic organisms. They develop as juveniles down in the water. But with midges and mayflies, they're very different groups of insects. Mayflies are kind of these ancient primitive type insects. If you look at the insect evolutionary tree of life, midges are related to mosquitoes and houseflies and things like that. So very different in terms of their appearance.
You mentioned their life cycle. I noticed that the day after some of these swarms, there was some sweeping up to be done around exterior lighting. How long do these midges last?
Well, it's interesting. If you think about their life cycle, they actually spend almost their entire life below the surface of the water. So they develop in water. They are aquatic. The worm-like larvae are often down amongst the sediment at the bottom of lakes where they're feeding on organic stuff that just sinks down to the bottom of the lake. So in that regard, they're doing some beneficial things. They're kind of acting as nature's garbage men or recyclers, if you will. They also serve as a great food source for fish and other aquatic animals. So they spend probably 98-ish% of their life cycle below the water surface. When they come above the water, the larvae eventually pupate, they transform to the adult stage. The adults are short-lived. They are maybe active for about two-ish weeks. And for the most part, the adults aren't even feeding. But again, it does tend to be a very short period of activity, but it can be very intense as well.
If they're not feeding, what's feeding on them, PJ?
Oh, all sorts of things. And when you think about it, again, this is a temporary ephemeral thing. So it's not like they're a massive food source all season long. But for above ground creatures like birds, bats, reptiles, amphibians, frogs, things like that, they can feed on these. And if they're very abundant at a given point in time, that can be a great food source. Recently, while I was doing some TV interviews about these, we went down to the Lakeshore Path on the UW-Madison campus, and you just look at any spider web near there, and the spiders are just having a great time at the moment. Dinner is coming to them. They don't have to do much at all. And I saw some really tiny little jumping spiders where they've got 10, 12 of these just sitting around waiting to be eaten.
Just a feast. What made them so intense this year? What is the difference between, in you know, the kinds of swarms that seems like smoke and sounds like interstate traffic and what I don't remember them this intense in the recent years. So what's made the difference this year?
Yeah, that's a really great question and hard to pin down exactly why that may be. I have suspicions that it may be due partly to some of the weather patterns we've had in Wisconsin the last couple of years. You know, we've had some periods of drought, periods of heavier rain, and if that influences nutrients coming into the lake and organic material sifting down, that may be part of it. But historically, at least for Madison area here, in the last 15 to 20 years, I recall quite a few springs where we have just had some massive swarms of these from time to time, where, as I said, it looks like clouds of smoke from a distance.
Sure. Let's go to your calls now for our guest, entomologist PJ Leash from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. It's 1-800-642-1234, where Jim in Kenosha County is standing by. Good morning, Jim.
Some questions about that critter. Before, I just wanted to comment that it's kind of amazing when you are on the beach, you can walk through these clouds and they don't even touch you.
Yeah.
The only exception is if you're sweating, if you're running or on a bike, you know, then pep, 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 and then they'll stick to you. But thank heavens they don't bite, right?
Absolutely.
They're also a good gauge for my screens. If they get into my house, I'm like, uh-oh, got to check the screens. But my questions is regarding in the lake, since they spent so much time down there in the mud, do they work in conjunction with nitrifying bacteria? And then when they come above out of the, between the time they come out of the mud and fly, do they provide food for any of our game fish?
Oh, great questions, Jim. PJ?
Yeah, those are really good questions. So I'm not aware of them working in conjunction with any nitrifying bacteria. Not that it couldn't be the case. I'd have to dig in the literature, but again, I just have not heard of anything like that. In terms of serving as a food for various fish, they certainly are fish food. The larvae, they're down in the sediment. They're going to pupate. They have to come up to the surface of the water for the adults to emerge. And so as they are going upwards, that could serve as potential food for a pretty wide range of fish and other animals that are swimming through the water. So definitely an important role in terms of the ecosystem benefits there, serving as a base of food web. And it's also interesting what you mentioned. I mean, just the clouds of these, you can walk through them. And in most cases, you know, you just kind of part the cloud and go right on through, and they don't stick to you or anything. They don't bite. They don't even have biting type mouth parts. So they're really quite harmless. I will share the one interesting story I had. This was about 17, 18 years ago as a graduate student. I had been out doing field work, got back to the Madison campus late one evening. It was about 8 o'clock or so, parked in a parking lot on campus down towards the Lakeshore Path. The midges were very active. And these midges will actually create these mating swarms above visually contrasting objects. So that could be if you have like a large light colored boulder in the landscape, you might see a cloud of them above that or some other contrasting objects. Well, in this particular parking lot, the parking lot was basically empty. So dark blacktop, but you have the yellow lines for the parking spots. And above almost every single line was this nearly two-dimensional plane of these midges. And I remember walking through those thinking, this is just the most surreal thing to be able to see this, where above every line is just an assemblage or grouping of these insects. It was definitely pretty cool, pretty interesting behavior when you think about it.
Totally surreal, but there's got to be a science behind it, right? What's the science of these swarms?
Yeah, I mean, from the insect's point of view, they don't have that long to be able to mate, because again, the adults are maybe out for about two-ish weeks. They are being kind of picked off by spiders and birds and bats and things like that. So they need to have an efficient way to be able to mate. And so due to some of the evolutionary forces involved, most likely, if they had evolved a behavior to form these swarms above some object that contrasts and stands out in the landscape, that could be an effective strategy, because other midges in the area can readily see that contrasting object, go to the same location. So it's fascinating behavior.
Yeah, you wouldn't think of insects as being that smart, but that seems rather wise in their activities. But also, to Jim's point about their connections to our waters, can we make any inference about the quality of our lakes or the arrival of invasive species as a result of from witnessing our midge swarms?
Oh, that's a great question. And with midges, remember, this is an entire family of flies, the family Chironomidae, and there's a bunch of different species out there. And anytime you have a very diverse group of insects, you're going to have some species that can do well in kind of poor conditions. You're going to have some that need more kind of cleaner, more pristine conditions. And so it's hard to gauge water quality per se just by the presence of midges without knowing the species. I will say there are some midge species where the larvae actually have a bright red appearance, and they're sometimes called bloodworms. This is due to the presence of hemoglobin in their bodies. And we know of hemoglobin from our blood because oxygen can bind to it. Well, these insects, if they are down in the sediment at the bottom of a lake, those are low oxygen or anoxic conditions. But because they have that hemoglobin in their body, it allows them to more readily bind oxygen and survive in some basically kind of muck-like conditions at the bottom of the water. So to get back to your question, though, in terms of water quality, it can be all across the board. You can have midges in kind of poor water conditions. You can also have some in cleaner conditions. But it's interesting because as a whole, there was a scientist here at UW-Madison decades ago, Dr. Bill Hilsenhoff, who developed a biotic index where basically you could sample water, look at the creatures that are present, and because if you know the biology of those creatures, you could gauge how clean or dirty that water is based on the species you're finding there.
Well, here's an interesting email from Mary in Mountain, Wisconsin, who reports a tremendous midge hatch in their yard. Mary says she's in the woods, has a tiny decorative pond that has a plastic bottom, no mud. There's a fountain running when it's not winter. Is there something they can put into the water to help prevent midges? She says she's got nothing living in the pond, but the birds, turkeys, and deer all drink from it.
Yeah, interesting. And for me, it'd be really fascinating to look at like a satellite view of the yard. And we know there's that fountain present. Usually, I wouldn't think of a small, you know, kind of a landscape ornamental type fountain in a yard as being a huge source for these. But if we were to zoom out on the map, so to speak, and look at the landscape around the given yard, if within, say, you know, a half mile or a mile, there's some bodies of water, ponds, lakes, streams, and things like that, it's very possible that the source of the midges is somewhere else, and they just happen to be kind of flying into the area. To really know for sure, you'd almost have to take a scoop or ladle or something like that and kind of scoop down to the bottom of that little ornamental pond. But I'm really suspicious that those midges may be originating elsewhere in this case.
We've heard with you as a guest on the show before, people calling in and anecdotally reporting there seem to be less insects than there used to be back in the day, not so long ago. But I would imagine that the healthy midge swarms suggest something positive, at least, for the insect population in Wisconsin, PJ.
Well, potentially, and there are certainly a lot of research papers coming out along the lines of insect declines. And with insect declines, it's hard to pick out the overall trends because with the biology of insects, we know they can have a lot of variability just by their very nature, kind of these booms and busts. If there's good conditions for them, you can have massive numbers of them. They're just able to take advantage of those conditions. And then the next year it might be down. And so if you were to draw a line of all this, it's zigzagging up and down all over the place, a lot of noise, so to speak. And so it's really hard to pick out those long-term trends. To really do that, you would need to look at years and essentially, ideally, decades of data. And also, when you think about a given species, that's kind of one data point or one bit of information. You have to look at insects as a whole. And we know with things like climate change and insect declines or changes, there's probably going to be some winners and also losers in that situation. So really hard to gauge what that may mean by having a good mid-year like we're having at the moment.
PJ Leash is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and we're answering your question, starting with the mystery of the Mother's Day Midge Hatch of 2025, which I feel like we've gone a long way in solving. Also solving your insect questions today at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Paul, give me a minute and we'll get right to you with our guest PJ Leash. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. The insects all around us, or some who may seem to be conspicuously missing. It's what we're talking today about today with our guest, entomologist PJ Leash from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, handling your questions about bugs and the creepy crawlies, the flyers, and those that don't have any legs at all. 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We take a photo as well and try to figure that out for you. And PJ, you had said that midges and mosquitoes are related?
They are, yes. If you were to look at the kind of insect tree life, both are members of a group we call the order Diptera. Di meaning two, Terra meaning wings. As adults, these insects only have two wings total, or one pair of wings on their body. Most other insects that have wings as adults are going to have four wings. So if you think about a moth or a butterfly, they've got their pair of four or front wings and then their pair of hind wings. But again, this group of insects, only one pair of wings. It turns out that their hind wings have shrunken down to these itty-bitty little clubs called halteres. They're involved with kind of balance during flight, but you'd be hard to see them with your naked eye. You got to get them under the microscope. But within the Diptera tree of life, things branch off a couple different directions, but both mosquitoes and midges are fairly closely related within that kind of little twig and the overall tree of life.
With that, let's go to Paul in Baraboo, who has a question for us. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
What's up?
Well, I would like to talk and piggyback off of what you were talking about with insect decline. I purchased a home, my wife and I, in rural Baraboo about 30, 33 years ago, and the mosquitoes were just terrible. We had a deck on the back of our house, and we had an oak, maple, some pines, woods in the background, and they were so terrible that at times we couldn't spend any time outdoors on our deck or having any enjoyment in our yard. And I've noticed even in woodsy areas around the state when I've been out that there seems to be a decline in less mosquitoes. And I have a cousin who's a meteorologist, and I talked to him about this, and he said he thinks that part of it, some of the research, and I want to give a clarification here, has to do with something called neonicotinoids, something of that sort. And I know that mosquitoes are an important part of the food chain, very important part. And, you know, people hate them because of their bite, of course, but you got bats and other animals that do depend upon them for their livelihood. So that's my question.
Where have you, how recent have you seen this change, Paul? Is this something over years? How recent is this for you?
I think it's been gradual, but I think mainly in the last 10 years. I know we sold the home and my daughter, actually, and they are on their deck all the time. No problems whatsoever. No mosquitoes, absence in that area where they used to be so prevalent.
It is not too different than a lot of the anecdotal reports that we have heard across Wisconsin, PJ, and the effect that insecticides like, what was it called,
neonicotinoids.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it could be a number of things going on here. We do have a lot of research going on with neonicotinoids. We know in some parts of the state, for example, these particular insecticides are used very heavily agriculturally. They can be put onto crops essentially at the time of planting. And from a farmer's point of view, you know, that saves you a trip out in the field. You don't have to spend money on gas later on to go and spray a field if it's got protection kind of built in, so to speak, because it's on there at the time of planting. So these do get used a lot. Some of my colleagues, like Dr. Russ Groves, have and his lab members have looked at some issues with groundwater contamination in the state and just these insecticides making it into other areas where ideally we would not have them. Hard to tell, though, how much of that would be impacting mosquitoes per se. One thing with mosquitoes that kind of complicates things a bit is a mosquito isn't a mosquito isn't a mosquito. We have in Wisconsin about 55 different species, and each species has its own preference for the type of water that it goes to, their life cycle, overall habits throughout the year and things like that. So we have some mosquitoes that can do very well, for example, in urban environments, in rainwater catch basins. Other ones may be like cattail marshes. They also differ in terms of how far they can fly. Some mosquitoes stay relatively close to home, flying less than a mile, maybe half a mile in some situations, whereas other mosquitoes can easily fly or get blown in 5, 10, 20 miles down the road. And so with that said, we know with insect declines and also just changes in general, land use and landscape changes are probably having all sorts of impacts. Now, you might not see that in your yard if there have been drastic land use changes 5 or 10 miles down the road. You may not be aware of those, but that could have some sort of subtle impact. If we look at the bigger picture for mosquitoes, it's interesting to me because if you go back in the history books, for example, we know in Wisconsin, the course of Wisconsin history, there was a lot of draining of wetlands and things like that. And if you go back into the 1800s, we actually had some issues with malaria due to mosquito spread here in the state of Wisconsin. We know it's not an issue for us now, because of land use changes, like draining those wetlands. And so that may be part of it. Another thing, though, and I have seen this very pronounced in the last 3 to 5 years with our overall weather patterns, we have bumped into some very dry, droughty stretches of weather. Now, it's raining here in Madison today, and yesterday we got quite a bit of rain. But when we have some dry, droughty periods, that can really suppress mosquito activity. And so depending on where you are in the state, a lot of areas in southern Wisconsin have had, for the most part, a reprieve the last couple of years. Now, there certainly were hot spots, but many areas in southern Wisconsin, mosquitoes have not been all that bad going on 3 to 5-ish years. Whereas if you're up in, say, the North Woods and there's plenty of water around, you always seem to have mosquitoes. So the point I want to make is there can be a lot of factors at play that end up influencing your local mosquito activity.
From insecticides to land use changes to climate change.
Climate change, weather patterns. We know, for example, if we just have like a really, really rainy year, there are some mosquitoes we commonly call floodwater mosquitoes, and they can take advantage of very temporary bodies of water. And they actually will have laid eggs out in the woods in other locations already. The eggs could have been there from last year or a couple years back. The eggs are just sitting there waiting for those low-lying areas or tire tracks made by logging equipment or something like that to fill up with water. And the water might be there for 3 weeks total before it dries up and is gone. But when we get those heavy rains, that can set the stage. And when those floodwater mosquitoes come out, it's often from one moment to the next, boom, huge numbers of them coming out all at once. So it's possible with some of the rain we've had this spring that if we look forward and fast forward a couple of weeks, we may have quite a bit of mosquito activity in some areas.
How long can those mosquito eggs lie dormant before they grow?
Yeah, great question. For some of these floodwater mosquitoes, it can easily be in the range of a couple of years.
Wow.
And that is their strategy, is they just deposit those, not even in water, but maybe in areas that are dry at the time, but might be prone to flooding. So low-lying spots out in the woods. And then once the rains come, that kind of lights the fuse, so to speak. And then it's just a matter of time before the adults come out.
Paul, really appreciate the question. And PJ, thank you for the response. I have an email here from Daniel, who says he rarely sees wild bees or any insects on flowering plants these days, and questions the has a question about general collapse in insect numbers. And we've sort of talked about this and how it can go up and down and there's zigzags, but there are questions about our pollinators and their health, aren't there, PJ?
Oh, yes, without a doubt. Lots of questions about that. I mean, just from my own observations, we have a crab apple in our front yard that is blooming at the moment. And when I think back to, we've been in our house close to 10 years, and some of those first years, you'd get a stretch of nice weather, you know, around Mother's Day or a little bit after that, where the crab apple's blooming and the thing is just alive with insects flying around it. And this year and the last couple years, it's been somewhat subdued. Similar to some of the other things we've talked about, there can be a lot of factors for that. It can be potentially pesticide use. It can be land use changes and things like that. And so that really makes it hard to pick out some of those trends in the long run. And I like to make the analogy, it's not one single thing. If that were the case, we could go to that proverbial switch and flip it in the other direction and correct the issue. It's more of death by a thousand paper cuts. It's a whole bunch of interacting factors. But to get to the caller's point, we definitely have concerns about bees. And numerically speaking, in Wisconsin, we've got close to 500 species of bees. Most of those are these solitary wild bees. They are excellent pollinators, pound for pound. They can be better than honeybees in some cases. Some live in the ground. Some live in hollow plant stems and things like that. But if we are talking about bees, we don't want to jump to the conclusion of being concerned about honeybees. I think we need to be much more concerned about these wild solitary bees.
So if we're keeping score at home, Wisconsin has 500 species of bees and 55 species of mosquitoes?
Yep, somewhere in that range, yeah.
It must be a challenge to keep track of. And while there are questions about dwindling numbers of our insects and pollinators, there seems to be no lack of ticks around Wisconsin, whether we're north, south, east, or west. Again, anecdotally, it seems tick reports are everywhere in our state, PJ.
They are definitely. And the tick situation to me is fascinating. I mean, most of us grew up being familiar with the American dog tick, which we also commonly call the wood tick. That one you can find basically across the state. And that, in my mind, is probably our commonest tick overall, or certainly in the top two or three. The deer tick, though, has been interesting. And the reason I say that is we didn't find and confirm our first deer tick in Wisconsin until about the late 1960s. A faculty member of the department, Gene DeFoliard, published an article in early 1970s documenting the presence of deer ticks in northern Wisconsin. If we fast forward from around 1970 to today, so we're talking, what, about 55 years, something like that. And today we can find deer ticks in basically any county in the state. Mm. And with that said, I really think of it as almost like we're watching the Big Bang happen. You know, we had that initial spot where they were, and they're radiating outwards, and it's still expanding. We don't necessarily know when or where they're going to stop expanding their range. Historically, you know, if we went back 2-3 decades, you would think a deer tick is something you have to pay attention for if you're a hunter or avid hiker.
Right.
You're going out fishing, you're in deep in the woods. But nowadays in some parts of the state, my colleague Susan Paskowitz and her group, they've done research up towards Eau Claire where folks are starting to bump into ticks like this in their suburban backyards, which is a little alarming because of the health threats posed by ticks like deer ticks. So these are definitely having a good time of things in the state. And as I said, they're really kind of expanding and pushing into new areas where we haven't seen them before. So this is really something that has been emerging in our lifetime.
So what are the health threats from these ticks, PJ?
It depends on the tick species, and kind of like mosquitoes, not all mosquitoes transmit diseases. There's some bad apples in the bunch. There's some mosquitoes that are more of a nuisance and not so much a disease threat. With these ticks, something like that wood tick or American dog tick, they technically can transmit a few things, but it tends to be exceedingly rare. So personally, if I've bitten by one of these wood ticks, I really don't worry about that. But deer ticks, we know they can carry Lyme disease. May happens to be Lyme Disease Awareness Month, so this is a very timely topic. Lyme disease is the main tick-borne disease that I'm concerned about in the state. But those same deer ticks can also transmit things like anaplasmosis, babesiosis. There's a Powassan virus, which has been in the news a little bit recently. There is a newer tick called the Lone Star tick, which for the most part is much more common to the south of us. You go to like Kentucky, Tennessee, Missouri, southern Illinois. That's the typical range of that Lone Star tick.
Is that the tick that can make you allergic to red meat?
It can, yeah. And we're starting to see more of that here in Wisconsin. So that Lone Star tick can carry a disease called ehrlichiosis. But as you just mentioned, we have something called the alpha-gal reaction. There's something in the tick saliva that if it bites you, in your depending on how your immune system reacts to it, it can make you allergic to red meat. So we definitely have some health concerns with ticks, but it depends and varies from tick species to tick species.
So you mentioned some of the other diseases that can be transmitted by these deer ticks beyond Lyme disease. Anaplasmosis, what are these?
Yeah, anaplasmosis, so that one is actually related to Lyme disease, and it's treated very similarly by medical professionals. There's also babesiosis, which is somewhat like malaria in terms of some of the ways that it harms us and harms our bodies by getting into blood cells, for example. But each of these diseases is a little bit different. I know there are some really good guides out there, I believe from CDC or other groups, that are basically guides for physicians and other medical professionals and provide some guidelines for them in terms of how to appropriately treat these diseases. So doctors do have a lot of medications at their disposal, but I think in the grand scheme of things, I would rather not get a tick-borne disease than have to treat it. So prevention is a key thing in my mind.
And prevention would include what? It would include bug spray, long sleeves, and tucked-in socks?
Yeah, I mean, those are some of the kind of gold standard things that we do. Long sleeve clothing and tucking into socks, you have a physical barrier between the tick and your skin. If it cannot get to your skin, it cannot bite you. So that can be a great approach. Repellents like DEET, and there's a number of other EPA registered repellents with science backing them up. And some folks just don't like DEET because of the greasy feel or this or that. There's some other good options out there. And I've seen all these at local hardware stores. There's Picaridin, IR3535. There's a botanical or plant-based one, which contains oil of lemon eucalyptus. And all these can work, but you need to read the product label, see if it says to apply it to clothing or skin. There's some differences there. It'll also tell you roughly how long it's going to last and how often you may need to reapply it. So doing that can work. If you are an avid outdoors person, you know, a hunter, you like fishing or hiking, or if you just know that your yard or a place you like to visit has high tick activity, there's also a product out there, well, a number of products, but they contain the ingredient permethrin. And this is a chemical that has repellent properties. It irritates ticks, but it also has a acaricidal or insecticidal properties. It can kill the ticks if they contact it long enough. Now, this is not a repellent like DEET where you would spray it on your clothes when you're wearing them. Rather, this is something you would lay out your pair of outdoor clothes that you wear and maybe socks or boots, things like that. You would spray them, allow the treatment to dry, and it can work very, very well and last through a number of washings. So again, for someone that is maybe an avid hunter, hiker, you're into fishing, that can be a great option. And then in my mind, one of the most important things for ticks, like deer ticks, is that tick check. And the reason I say that is that there is a really important time component for disease transmission. A tick does not just bite you and give you Lyme right away. It's actually a long, drawn-out process. They insert their mouth parts. they actually go through this process of almost gluing their mouth parts in place, so it makes them harder to be detached. But for a deer tick, for example, to transmit Lyme disease, they really need to be attached and feeding for about a day and a half. And each disease has slightly different time increments in terms of how long it takes for transmission. But point I want to make is the longer that tick is attached, the greater the risk. But for something like Lyme, about a day and a half. So if you go out hiking, if you have a deer tick biting you, but it's only been on 2 hours, 4 hours, 8 hours, maybe you're taking a shower at the end of the day and you find that tick and remove it, by virtue of that short period of time, you have greatly reduced any chance of transmission, even if the tick is positive for Lyme. And at the moment, about 20% of our juvenile ticks are Lyme positive in the state, and about 40% of the adult deer ticks are positive for Lyme in Wisconsin. So that time component, removing ticks quickly, is a really important precaution.
Do ticks have any predators?
You know, they do to a certain extent, but in my mind, nothing that really makes a huge difference. What would perhaps make the biggest difference is if the environmental conditions were just right and a naturally occurring pathogen popped up. There are what we call entomopathogens. These are disease organisms, microbes like bacteria or fungi that specifically attack insects and ticks and mites and things like that. And they can sometimes pop up under damp conditions. There's actually been some research on using these microorganisms as essentially a biopesticide, but you need the conditions to be right. But I know if you hop online, there's all sorts of, you know, kind of what I refer to as kind of urban myths about various animals, especially things like possums come up again and again, that possums will kind of go around and hoover them up like a vacuum cleaner. But I've dug into the literature and there's papers that document like the gut contents of possums and other things. And you're just not seeing huge numbers of ticks on there. Some of it goes back to old stories decades ago where maybe in a controlled situation, such as a lab study, you present an animal with a certain number of ticks and they said, oh, this animal ate X number of ticks in 5 minutes or whatever the time interval is. And then you extrapolate up to a 24-hour or longer time period. And out in nature, it just does not work like that. So again, there's things that might feed on them, but in terms of impacting tick populations, nothing that is going to have huge impacts.
PJ Leash, our guest, entomologist with the UW-Madison Diagnostic Lab. Martha, give me 2 minutes and we'll get right to your question. And we have some solutions or tools you can use to help deal with ticks. We'll get to that when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. It's The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our guest, entomologist PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. We've been taking a look at ticks who are found now all across Wisconsin and what you can do to fight back. You can also join us with your questions about bugs, where you find them, 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go to Martha in Menominee next. Martha, good morning.
Hey, Lee. Great job filling in for Larry today. You know, I've had Lyme disease 3 times now, also tested positive for the anaplasmosis or whatever. But here's one thing that I heard. Maybe your guest could comment on this. You can, you know, I've got all the sprays. I've got the netting. I wear my barn boot, you know, my dairy barn boots when I go out in the woods. But what I read, and maybe your guest can tell me if this is true, is that you're more often to get lit on by a tick from overhead, from trees, from them dropping from trees, rather than the old myth we used to think that they nestled in the leaves.
Yeah.
So if you're not wearing a hat or protecting your head, from what I've learned, three-time loser now here, that it's really important to protect your head. So maybe your guest could comment on that.
PJ, say it isn't so.
It isn't so.
Man, Martha had me scared there for a second.
Well, no, this is a common thing. I have heard lots of reports of this, just this general idea that, you know, ticks will drop on you out of trees, which just doesn't seem to be the case. So a couple important points about tick biology that relate to this. So if you were to have a conversation with a tick, and I know this is anthropomorphizing here, but one of the biggest challenges ticks have on a day-to-day basis is desiccation or drying out, especially if it's, you know, a sunny, breezy day. And I've had some colleagues in the department that have looked at tick behavior over like a 24-hour period, and they found that the ticks are basically climbing up onto tall, weedy plants like grasses and things like that, maybe onto some lower shrubs. But then they have to keep making these trips back down to the ground level where there's higher moisture levels. You know, if they get down to soil or amongst leaf litter, they can basically wick up moisture into their bodies and rehydrate. Once they have rehydrated, they can go back up to those areas on vegetation. So with that said, they really don't want to climb too far above ground for risk of drying out and dying. So that can be a big concern for them. Also, it depends on the tick species, but some ticks don't have eyes. And if you look at the eyes of ticks, they're very simple, the ones that they do have. And so they're not going to have great vision compared to something like, you know, a dragonfly, which we know dragonflies can see very well, maneuver through three-dimensional space to catch other moving insect prey. They've got good vision. Ticks, not so much. So their main way of getting onto hosts is what we call questing. They climb onto those grassy, weedy plants. They will climb onto maybe low shrubs, and then they just sit there and they stick their legs out. And if you look at vegetation this time of the year and you happen to find a tick, they may be moving, waving their legs a little bit, just hoping for an animal to walk by. That's how they get onto you versus dropping out of trees. However, I will say ticks are very, very good climbers. And I've experienced this personally where I know I've gone to locations where there happened to be ticks. I was there because I was looking for morel mushrooms. I know I've had situations where I knew the tick could not have been on me longer than about 3 to 5 minutes, and it had to have gotten on from grassy weeds about knee height. But within just a few minutes, it got up to basically shoulder level. Yeah. So they're very good at climbing, which if they get up to your armpit, your scalp, that gives the impression that they're coming from above, but they're really not. They're coming from lower down, climbing up onto you.
Check for ticks. And Martha, thank you so much for the question, because it does make sense when you find them in your upper exterior, in your armpits and in your neck. And PJ, as I understand it, they tend to look for the nooks and crannies.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they like to get under edges of clothing where they can maybe use that to help press themselves onto you. But yeah, they love to get into those nooks and crannies.
Now, what can we do about the tick population that seems to be all across Wisconsin, no matter where you are? The UW-Madison Department of Entomology has released a tick app. You can find it at tickapp.us. PJ, tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is an app that Dr. Susan Paskowitz, our medical entomologist, and some of her lab members created several years ago, and it's an easy-to-use smartphone app. I've got it on my own phone, and basically you can volunteer a bit of information, take a short daily kind of survey, and it's going to ask you just a few questions. Did you find a tick? Yes or no? And depending on answers to those questions, it may give you some follow-up ones. Did you take tick precautions? If you found a tick, do you know what species it is? There's also features in the app where you can use that to help identify the tick species, and listeners can always, you know, contact me if they're trying to identify a tick species as well. But that's a really great, easy-to-use app. And it's the data going into this goes to researchers who are using it to answer all sorts of questions about ticks here in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country. We have some colleagues in New England working on the app as well. And so it's allowing scientists to get a better feel for where are we finding ticks, and also some of the social human aspects and questions along those lines, like what are folks doing and how does that tie in with risk for human health?
That's tickapp.us, and we'll have a link up on the show note page today at wpr.org/Larry. Let's go to Bob in Land O'Lakes. Bob, good morning.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I live at on the top, you know, in Vilas County at the top of Wisconsin. We've always had wood ticks, but deer ticks have started appearing about on my property around 6 years ago or so, and now they're pretty common. But one thing I've noticed, I used to have dogs, and even with putting, you know, frontline protection, you know, it's it would basically repel the ticks, but they were, I was still removing engorged ticks off my dogs. And, you know, one time I put one in a jar, and in the course of about a week, all of a sudden there were like hundreds of little baby ticks in there. So
each
produced huge amounts of ticks. But what I found was we stopped having dogs about maybe 10 years ago, and not having the dogs.
Oh, no, you're cutting out. Like, what a cliffhanger. But I would imagine that not having the dogs means probably not seeing as many ticks. And I've heard the story as well that despite their best efforts of applying some sort of tick prevention on pets, their pets still come home with ticks on them.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a number of veterinary products out there. And my wife actually happens to be a small animal vet. So she deals with some of this as well. And there are some of the products that will help with ticks, but it may not be an immediate kill. It might take a little bit longer versus there's some other products that may work a little bit faster. So if you do live in an area like the North Woods, like many folks do, and you just happen to have some ticks in your yard, I would recommend having a chat with your veterinarian just to discuss the situation and see if there's a slightly different product you could choose that might help and work a little bit more quickly in cases like that. Because as I said, it can be a little alarming when you keep finding ticks on your animals.
Sure, but and also, as Bob mentioned, bringing them in the house, you put it in a jar and all of a sudden there were 100 in a jar. So if they come in the house and they eventually die, but they would have the chance to perhaps repopulate inside the home?
Well, I mean, some good news along those lines, and yes, ticks can hitchhike in on pets. I've had this happen personally with some of our dogs over the years. Some good news, though, is ticks, they really would not be able to do well indoors. They wouldn't be able to survive. And it's interesting with tick biology, if you think about like a deer tick, their lifespan is actually about 2 years.
Wow.
And I said earlier, one of the biggest threats to them is drying out or desiccation. And so if they are indoors, it's generally too dry for them. You got AC during the summer months, the winter months, it's the humidity is bone dry. So they wouldn't be able to survive in the long run. But still, it's not fun, and it can be a little bit alarming if your animals are always bringing some hitchhikers inside.
So what about, I mean, how many babies can one tick make?
Yeah, it'll vary a bit from species to species, but it easily can be hundreds of eggs.
Quick email here, PJ, about your favorite insect identification guide. What would you recommend?
Oh, gosh. My favorite one. So many callers are going to be familiar with the Peterson Field Guide series. They've got guides for birds and things like that. There is a Peterson Field Guide to insects, but that was last issued in like the 70s or 80s.
Oh.
I will say, as an entomologist, I still use it because it has some great diagrams and line drawings in there. So for doing diagnostics, it's useful. There's a newer book, though, that was going to be the follow-up for the Peterson Field Guide series, but Peterson has stopped producing the Field Guide series. So those two authors went to the folks at the Princeton Field Guide series. So just in about the last 2 years, there's a new Princeton Field Guide to Insects of North America, which is just an awesome book. I cannot recommend it enough. If someone is looking for like one field guide for insects, that has got to be one of my favorite books at the moment, that Princeton Field Guide to Insects of North America.
And of course, you can also submit your insects to the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and PJ and his team will take a look at it for you. I've got about 30 seconds here, PJ. What's the easiest way to get these bugs your way?
Well, what I would suggest is just hopping online and doing an internet search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. You'll find my website. I've got all the instructions on there. If you send me photos, I've got my email on the website. If you want to send me a sample, the most important thing, and the analogy I make is pretend you are mailing your mom a pair of earrings. You don't want those squished. Don't put it just in a paper envelope. Put it in a small box, an empty pill vial, small Tupperware to protect it during shipping. That's important. Otherwise, when it gets to me, it's just squished bug parts.
Our conversation with PJ continues for the next 30 minutes, along with your calls and emails at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on WPR News. We're getting an insect update today from PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, talking about the insects on the move in Wisconsin this time of year and answering your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and let's go straight to your calls and questions, and we'll start with Mark in Suamico. Mark, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity. First of all, forget the bugs. I want the exact geolocation where you're looking for morels when you're accosted by a tick.
That may be privileged information, Mark, but
oh,
we'll ask.
Dang the luck. No, on a more serious point, I was visiting with a friend who was working in a garden, volunteering at the Botanical Gardens in Asheville, North Carolina, and he was in the midst of a brood emergence of 17-year locusts. Cicadas.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, is it possible that the midges have multiple-year broods, kind of like the same thing, where they're hanging out in the mud for a couple of years? That's why you only see them every 8-10 years?
That's interesting, and we were talking about the mystery of the Mother's Day midge hatch of 2025, which in the Madison area was like clouds of smoke and sounds like the interstate traffic. And PJ, do we have broods for midges?
No, not in the way that we do for those periodical cicadas. With the midges, it depends on the species, but their overall life cycle is generally going to take a year or two. So that's something meaning that we see them, at least some of them, numbers can vary, but we'll see some of them every single year. But we won't see those absolutely massive emergences at very predictable points in time. It's not like we can mark our calendar and say, okay, 5 or 8 years, we're going to have a big one again. It doesn't quite work like that with these insects.
Any tips for Mark on his morel hunting?
Well, look for dead elm trees.
That'll get you a start, Mark, and thanks for the call. Stephanie in Washburn, you're next. Good afternoon.
Hi, guys. Good afternoon. I'm sorry, I tuned into the radio right as you were finishing going from bees to ticks, so maybe you've answered this question. My husband and I live on 20 acres outside of Washburn. We've got wild plums, blueberries, and dandelions blooming everywhere, and we haven't seen any pollinators. I don't know if wasps pollinate. We haven't seen wasps, bees, hornets, moths, butterflies, bumblebees, nothing this year. Now, I know it's been cold, but we had a couple of 80-degree days, and I would have expected to have seen something on those days, and we have seen absolutely nothing. And it's curious if I have any idea what's going on.
And Stephanie, when you say zero, you mean zero, right? Not a few?
I mean literally not a one. Not a one. It's kind of alarming us. We want apples and blueberries this year, you know?
Yeah. PJ?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, with weather, that can certainly influence the activity of pollinators. And when it comes to pollinators, I mean, folks think of bees first and foremost, and for good reason. I mean, bees have specifically evolved to carry lots of pollen back to their nests and things like that. And they're important pollinators. There's also plenty of flies, butterflies and things like that. Some beetles can be pollinators. One thing to keep in mind is that, you know, folks generally recognize the honeybees, the bumblebees. We have a lot of our wild solitary bees that can be mistaken for something else and could be easily overlooked because they maybe are kind of drab color or rather small in terms of their appearance. I mean, we have some bees that are in the range of about, 3/16 or just under a quarter inch long. So not very big insects. I will also say one other really interesting area, which I'd love to see even more research in, folks tend to not focus on moths a whole lot in terms of the pollination services of those insects. I mean, people in general, I find when I interact with the public, they think of butterflies are flashy. We love those. Moths are drab. We don't care for moths as much. But that really shouldn't be the case. Moths can do a lot of nocturnal pollination, be excellent pollinators. But unless you're out there looking at the plants after dark with a headlamp, you miss this entirely. So I've seen some more recent research in the last decade or so along these lines, which was cool stuff. There was one experiment, I believe, down in Arkansas where they covered flowers in an orchard setting at night with little mesh bags, took them off during the day. The bees pollinated, you got fruit. They did the opposite thing. They covered them during the day to exclude bees, took them off at night. They got plenty of fruit. It was the moths that were doing it. So my suspicion is if you did some very intensive surveying, there's probably some pollinators out there, but without a doubt, it sounds like you just are not seeing much, which is eerie. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I have heard similar reports the last few years. And I made a comment earlier on the show about my own crab apple in my yard, where 10 years ago, I would have seen a lot more. Weather patterns can influence this. If we have a cool rainy day or really overcast day, you're just not going to see as much versus if it's a warm day. Given your location in Washburn, you know, you're cooler than us down here in Madison. And so there may be some component of that as well, because if you're talking about species that are solitary ground nesters, depending on what your soil temperatures are, that might be keeping those activity of those down and suppressed at the moment. But I would think as we get into more consistently warmer temperatures, I'd expect some activity to pick up. But definitely alarming that you seem to be seeing nothing out there on those plants.
What's the best thing we can do for our pollinators in Wisconsin? And is no mow May an effective measure?
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, we do hear a lot of press about no mow May. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I mean, no mow May, can it help to a certain extent? Yes, I have some colleagues that have actually researched turf grass settings. Dr. Jonathan Larson, University of Kentucky, he did some work for his PhD. He looked at urban lawns and suburban lawns with dandelion and clover. He found over 50 different insects going to those plants.
Wow.
So there's some benefit there. But if all you're doing is not mowing for the month of May, we have some pollinators that are out in April and May. We have some that are out in June, July, August, into the fall months. And so if we only focus our attention on the month of May, we're missing a lot of things. So one general concept, my colleague, Dr. Doug Soldot, our extension turfgrass specialist, one of them, he has kind of been using the phrase mow high in May, June, and July. So maybe extend that from May into a larger part of the year. And, you know, it doesn't have to be just an absence of mowing. There is a movement to put in kind of bee lawns where we incorporate a greater diversity of flowering plants in our yards. One thing that you can do very simply if you want to help pollinators is, I feel, increase the overall diversity of flowering plants that you have, because you are providing resources for them. And so that can be a great way to do it, especially focus on native plants. That's what our native bees would have emerged with. So increasing that number of flowering plants in your yard, and also having a diversity of blooming times. If we have a bunch of plants that bloom all in the month of June, that's great for the pollinators in June, but we've got pollinators active from April into the fall months. So it'd be great to have a spread of blooming time. So that's something you can do as well. And also trying to minimize or reduce pesticide use in your yard. Or, you know, there's sometimes cases you need to draw that line in the sand, but really make sure that it makes sense in a given situation to use a pesticide if you want to go that route.
Stephanie, thank you so much for the call. And your concern is others' concern as well, including our guest, PJ. We've been talking about ticks last hour, and we've got a couple tick questions here for you, PJ. David in Sturgeon Bay, we'll go to you next.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Before I get back to the ticks, quick with the morel point, with all these dead ass. I know morel sometimes are on ashes, not often, but occasionally they may become more popular there and become more common. Could be good.
There you go.
No, but with the ticks, you know, indoor county here, been here since 1989, and geez, for the first 20 years or so, you know, not a single tick found. I'm in the woods all the time, yards, woods, whatever. Now, the last 15-ish years or so, I mean, you can't go out without finding them. So yeah. I've tried to look over the years, and they research about, I don't know, limestone, karst topography, whatever reasons, Door County didn't seem to have too many ticks. But now that seems a moot point. But any idea on why they weren't around, up to 20 years ago?
Yeah, let's take it back 20 years, PJ, but I'd also like to take it forward 20 years and see if this trend of the tick population in Wisconsin can continue.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this earlier. So just to kind of set the stage again, you know, we didn't find our first deer tick or confirm it until about the late 1960s, and that was in kind of northwestern Wisconsin. Fast forward 5 or so decades, and now we can find deer ticks in just about any county in the state. It's been interesting to watch Door County, though, because until recently, we really didn't see much, if any, deer tick activity in that corner of the state. Part of it might have been a little bit of luck or chance when you think about it. Ticks themselves, because of their small size, they cannot travel very far on their own. And actually, when we found our first deer ticks in the state in the late 1960s, early 70s, it was kind of an interesting footnote at the time, because if you wanted to find that same species, you would go down to places like Texas. Mm-hmm. How did they get up here? Was it birds or other animals that migrated? Most likely. But when you think about if something like a bird is bringing in ticks, you know, if they drop in one male deer tick, you're not going to get a population. You need enough critical mass, enough males and females, a certain density per acre, something like that, so that they can actually successfully mate with each other. So there's a certain amount element of chance in a case like that. And for whatever time, or for whatever reason, if it just took longer for some of those or enough of those ticks to make it toward Door County where you could have an established reproducing population, that might influence kind of the pattern we've seen over time, where it's a somewhat newer thing in that corner of the state. If we fast forward, though, and I made this comment earlier, to a certain extent, it's like we're watching the Big Bang,
right?
You know, northwestern Wisconsin, and it's been expanding outwards. And so they are showing up in these areas where they just have not been historically. Even if you think about parts of the state where maybe they've been present for a while, they're still showing up in new spots. I live on the west side of Madison in Middleton, and I have some areas within a 10-minute car drive where I like to go hiking. And there's some spots where I know there's deer ticks, and I can go 5 minutes down the road and not bump into deer ticks there. So it can be very, very localized. So I think on a smaller scale over the next 20 years, it wouldn't surprise me if we saw ticks show up in more areas on kind of a local, finer resolution, so to speak.
Well, that just sounds like they'd be everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, we still know there's some habitats they just don't seem to do well in. I mean, in general, your typical home yard, like your urban, suburban yard, okay, if you have a classic lawn, that's generally too open for them, too dry, not usually going to be good tick habitat. Versus if you are, say, a suburban yard and you back up to a wooded area, they might have a much better go of things in the woods or at the edge of the woods where there's grassy, weedy plants. But over time, could those spill into your yard? And we are starting to see more of that sort of scenario play out in the state.
PJ, I have an email from Josh in La Crosse who says they're having issues with their grass not growing. He was told that they have a grub and mole issue, and Josh noticed mole trails and mounds. How can he get rid of the grubs that bring the moles to the yard? I've also heard other stories that white grubs have been doing a lot of turf grass damage this spring.
Yeah, it's been interesting. The last month or so, lots of reports of white grub activity. And white grub, when I say white grub, what I really mean is I'm referring to the larvae or juvenile stages of certain scarab beetles. Now, for scarab beetles, we have a whole bunch of different species, and most of them are not pests. Like some of our dung beetles are types of scarab beetles. Those are very much beneficial, and they will not harm your lawn. But there are some members of this group, like May June beetles, also called June bugs, Japanese beetles, mass chafers, European chafers. Those last two are kind of newer for us here in Wisconsin. And those species I just mentioned can be pests in turf grass areas because they'll feed on the roots of the grass that can cause these irregular brownish patches in lawns. In some cases, the damage can be rather severe and notable. However, I will say If you look at a lawn and you think there's grubs present, what you really need to do is confirm their presence. Now, if you have high grub populations and they sever the roots on the grass plants, you can walk over and almost pick up the lawn like a toupee or roll it back like a carpeting if you have severe grub damage. And sometimes you'll do that and the grubs are right there and there's your smoking gun. You know that was the culprit that did it. But moles can also feed on things like earthworms. So in my mind, if your main criteria for diagnosing grubs is you are seeing mole activity, presence of moles doesn't necessarily mean you've got grubs. So I would really recommend going out with a spade or shovel, doing some digging in the lawn area to see if you're finding these white grubs. White grubs themselves are usually fairly small, an inch or less in length. They have a distinctive C-shaped body, like the letter C. It has to do with the way their muscles are aligned in their body. So they're pale, C-shaped, whitish. They've got an orangish-brownish head capsule and three pairs of legs up towards the head. If you're finding a lot of those, then by all means, that is kind of that smoking gun. You have found that white grubs are indeed involved. There are some treatments for it, but it depends a little bit on the species. So in a case like this, first of all, I'd confirm the presence of grubs. If you find some, feel free to package some up and send them into the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab so I can tell you the exact species that will play into management decisions because the timing of treatments varies from species to species. Most of our species like Japanese beetle, mast chafer, European chafer have 1-year life cycle, but if it's something like May-June beetles, they have these complex 3-year life cycles, and that can complicate the management of them. And sometimes we have to choose different products. So I would start by simply confirming the presence of grubs. If you find some, get in touch with me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, and we can go from there.
Have an email from Cindy in Janesville who says their yard has been inundated with ground bees all spring, so they can vouch for pollinators at least around Janesville. Unfortunately, she says the bees have built their ground nest near the front walk, so she's trying to encourage them to move further away. Any suggestions, PJ?
Ooh, that's going to be hard to do. However, I mean, one thing to keep in mind about these ground bees, and sometimes when folks use the term ground bee, that can mean different things in different contexts. Usually when I hear the term ground bee, I hear it in the context of someone is mowing their lawn in August or September, and all these black and yellow things come out and sting them, and they're angry. Those are ground nesting yellow jackets, and they just mistakenly get called ground bees. When I think of a true ground bee, these are solitary insects. They make little nests that look like an anthill, and each female is going to have her own little nest. But if you're in a good spot, and they really seem to like sandy-ish soil because it's easy to dig in, they will set up shop, and you can have hundreds or thousands of these in a given area. It's going to be very hard to dissuade them from that area or get them to move elsewhere. My best suggestion would be to simply recognize, first of all, these are really beneficial pollinators, great insects to have. You could maybe even put up a little sign. And I do have an article about these on my website for the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. And I actually made a yard sign just talking about these. And feel free to track that down or shoot me an email. I can share that with you. And you can put this out just to let folks know, hey, these are really harmless creatures. Because they do not have a colony of relatives to defend, they tend to be exceedingly docile. I have lied down right next to these nests within inches of them. They have no interest in stinging you whatsoever. They're basically mini teddy bears in my mind. They're really cute to watch. But beneficial insects, and they're also active for a short period of time, usually for about 2 to 3 weeks. And so I like to communicate to folks, hey, this is something good to have in your yard. They're here because of the soil texture that's present, and we can't really change our soil texture, but they're going to disappear on their own within probably 2 to 3 weeks, and then you won't see them till next year.
They're just mini teddy bears.
With wings.
There you go. I have seen a few reports that suggesting that we have a new invasive insect around our area, the Asian needle ant. What's your take on what appears to be the appearance of Asian needle ants in Wisconsin, PJ?
Yeah, so I really don't have much to say on that topic. I did see a recent news article that happened to mention these Asian needle ants. And I thought, oh, that's interesting because I've never seen any samples of these at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. So I did a little bit of digging, and there happened to be one report back in about 2011, 2012. So, you know, 10 to 15-ish years ago, from one single spot in Wisconsin. And I actually tracked down the individual who identified the ants, and I sent them an email this morning to try and figure out any more details about these, because as I said, I've had no reports of these. So I do not think of them as being established here in Wisconsin. What I really wonder is if this had been a case where they might have been introduced with something such as houseplants, or if it were a greenhouse scenario. We do know there's a number of non-native ant species that have shown up in kind of these artificial situations. Maybe they're moved with plants into a greenhouse, and that species perhaps could not survive outdoors. So with that said, I really don't consider those Asian needle ants to be established in Wisconsin. I've had no reports at the diagnostic lab ever. So it's something I've reached out to the individual that confirmed the presence of them, but I really wonder if it might have been an introduction into a home with houseplants or maybe a greenhouse setting, and that might be the entire extent of the infestation. They might have even been eradicated at this point.
Yeah, because this would have been, what, 10, 15 years ago now almost?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and as I said, I've had no other reports of these since that time.
Two last questions quickly here, PJ. I want to get in as much as I can. Sam's email and Trista's email. One, Sam's friend has had Lyme disease for a month now. What's the best remedy? And Trista emailed to ask about the Lyme disease vaccination for dogs. Where is the Lyme disease vaccine for humans?
Yeah, great question. So in terms of the treatments, you know, I'm not a medical doctor, so I can't give out any sort of guidance on that. However, I did mention on the show earlier, there's some really good guidance for medical professionals, doctors and primary care and things like that. So there's good documentation. And I've seen some of these guides, I've looked at them just for reference, and it describes for the physicians, you know, what sort of antibiotics and other medications to use. So I would certainly refer to your physician and follow up with those sorts of questions to your primary care physician. And then what was the second part of the question? Oh, the vaccine. Yes, so there's a vaccine for animals like dogs. Historically, there was actually a Lyme vaccine. This would have been in the late 90s or so. And it was a three-dose vaccine because I actually got the first two doses of it. Then it was pulled from the market. There had been potential concerns about like neurological side effects, and it turns out that was not the case, but it had done enough harm that the vaccine just was not being marketed or sold. However, there's more research, and so I have been hearing rumblings about a new Lyme vaccine that may be coming to the market in the not-too-distant future.
Wow. So stay tuned. And Trista, thanks for the email. And to all the callers and emailers, and I'm sorry we didn't get to them all. We could do this all day. And for you, PJ, we thank you for your time and wisdom as always.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me today. It's been fun.
And we'll do it again. PJ Leash, entomologist and manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, where you can send your pictures of insects or your well-wrapped and protected insects, if you like. And that detailed information can be found on our website at wpr.org/Larry under today's episode page. Now, coming up next, it is American Wetlands Month throughout the country, and we're going to be talking with the Wisconsin Wetlands Association about the importance of our wetlands and what would it mean if Wisconsin lost them. Katie Belfis, our guest. Stay tuned. That's next. I'm Lee Rayburn on The Larry Miller Show. Let's celebrate our wetlands. After all, May is American Wetlands Month. It was established way back in 1991 by the EPA to help Americans understand the value of these wetlands, which not so long before that we would just fill in. And there were some consequences as a result of that. So let's celebrate our wetlands. Our guest, Katie Belfus, is the Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. And if you've got a question about our wetlands or want to celebrate them, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email anytime, talk@WPR.org. Katie Belfus, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you so much, Lee.
Yeah, let's start with the American Wetlands Month. Why did we first create this way back in 1991? What's the importance of it?
Well, wetlands are important for so many reasons. But as you said, we have had a long cultural history of not appreciating wetlands and actually actively working to get them out of the way because they were seen as wetlands that didn't contribute to our development as a nation or our ability to carry out our lives. So the establishment of American Wetlands Month is partly just to change that narrative and to help everybody understand why wetlands are so important and how they matter to the things that they care about, like clean water and wildlife habitat and flood protection. So a great opportunity to talk about those benefits.
Yeah, the wetlands are an incredible filtration system, aren't they?
Indeed, they are. They provide places for especially floodwaters to spread out and slow down and release their sediments, so those sediments drop out and don't go along into your lake and fill them up with sediment, but also processing the nutrients that are so often found in our waters. Many of the wetland plants are able to take up and process those nutrients, help clean the water.
Katie, what's the story of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association? Give us a brief history.
Sure. Well, the Wisconsin Wetlands Association is more than 50 years old. It was a volunteer organization for many years. We've had staff since the late 90s, early 2000s. And we have been working to help people and communities care for wetlands through outreach programs and policy and advocacy work and education. So we help landowners know if they have wetlands on their property, what kind of wetlands they are, how to determine if they're healthy, how to take care of them and make them more healthy. We work with local communities who are struggling with water quantity or water quality challenges, try to bring wetlands, the piece of wetlands, the piece of the solution that wetlands can bring to their challenges. And we work with state agencies to help them have programs and funding sources that help promote the protection and restoration of wetlands across Wisconsin so we can be more effective.
And speaking of promotion, there is an event tomorrow in Madison. Tell us a little bit about it and invite us out.
Yeah, we're just having a fun celebration of American Wetlands Month. It's going to be at Delta Beer Lab in Madison, which is just off the Beltline at Rimrock Road. It's 4 to 7 p.m., so come on down after work, and we'd love to have you.
And so I was thinking maybe the event would be held in some wetlands and you'd need to bring your waders, but no, it's going to be at the Delta Beer Lab, which makes more sense now that I think about it.
We do have a lot of events that we hold in the field as well, and we love getting out in wetlands. So stay tuned. We'll do some more field trips later this summer that we'll promote on our website.
We'll give you a reason to put on your waders. You mentioned healthy wetlands, and I want to know from your perspective what an unhealthy wetland looks like and what work is done to help restore that?
That's a great question. And often one of the things that tells us a wetland is unhealthy is the presence of invasive species or the development of sort of a monoculture, which often involves invasive species, but doesn't always have to be. Healthy wetlands are really diverse, have a lot of different plants, flowers and grasses and shrubs and sedges and all kinds of wonderful things. And when a wetland is less healthy, that diversity tends to go down, and we see more invasive species, including reed canarygrass and Phragmites, and even cattail, which a lot of folks consider sort of cattails ubiquitous with wetlands, right? That's your very image of wetland is cattail. And in Wisconsin, we have a native cattail, but we also have an invasive cattail, and they have come together to make a hybrid offspring that's really, really aggressive. And so often when you see cattails now, it's all you see where they're growing because they're taking over, and it just doesn't leave anything else room for other things, and it doesn't provide the kind of good quality habitat that many species are looking for.
That's very interesting. Now, you'd mentioned Wisconsin Wetlands Association, more than a half century old at this point, far older than the Wetlands American Wetlands Month, and older than the North American Wetlands Conservation Act, which I believe was made into law in 1989. What did that law do for our wetlands, Katie?
There are so many different laws, and I'm going to tell you, Lee, that's not my area of expertise, but I will say that we have a great policy staff here at the Wisconsin Wetlands Association who would be able to answer that question in a heartbeat, and I'm just going to have to bring them on next time so that they can do that.
I appreciate that. Go ahead.
But I will say that it has been great over the 50 plus years of our organization to see more wetland protection laws and promotion funding for wetlands and wetland restoration. That's wonderful, and we support all of that. And we support wetland regulations, and we also are really doing more work now to promote voluntary wetland protection and restoration, not because there's anything wrong with regulations, but because they are more subject to be able to change. We've had some dramatic changes at the federal level to federal wetland protections. Happily, here in Wisconsin, that has less of an impact because we have strong state level protections that sort of cover us. There's many states in the nation that don't have those state level protections. So when federal level protections change, they lose all of their protections. So in Wisconsin, we've done a great job making sure that we have those, but nobody likes being told what to do.
Sure.
And so our approach is to try to figure out what are the things that this community cares about and how can wetlands help them accomplish those things? What does this individual landowner care about? How does a wetland help them accomplish that thing?
And that's kind of why I was asking, Katie, is because there is a timeline here where the Wisconsin Wetlands Association was around before American Wetlands Month, was around before the North American Wetlands Conservation Act. But at least earlier this spring, there were announcements that there were plans to limit federal protections of wetlands. And there was some concern about how this would affect wetlands in Wisconsin, but it sounds like Wisconsin has stayed ahead of the game. Can they stay ahead of any rollback of federal protections?
Well, that is the goal. Mm-hmm. And yes, there have been numerous rollbacks to wetland protections at the federal level over the last 20 years. And each of them, you know, each time there's a Supreme Court decision or some changes at the federal level with the agency, with the EPA, that has ripple down effects. And we don't have control over that. That's happening outside our state. And so having our own state protections just gives us the power to do what's right and to protect those. And it is concerning to see what's happening at the federal level and what the ripple down effects will be, because the funding that comes through a lot of those sources will have an effect on state agencies, maybe on the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Everybody's waiting to find out because not all of that is clear yet. But it is worrisome, and that's one of the reasons that we really work on not only keeping those protections where we need them, but also implementing programs where people can invest voluntarily in doing the right thing and not be told what to do by the regulation.
Katie Belfis is the Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, as this is American Wetlands Month. But Katie, I'd like you to, if you would, put on your, look through your silver ball, and if you were to, crystal ball, and if you were to share with us what would change in Wisconsin with fewer wetlands across the state, what would our state look like?
I don't even need a crystal ball to answer that question, because we've already seen the impacts of what wetland loss, what happens when we lose wetlands. We have lost half of our wetlands in Wisconsin.
Wow.
And when you sort of line up the map of where the wetland loss has occurred and where we have water quality challenges, there's a really tight alignment, because when we lose wetlands, we lose the piece of our landscape that helps us process water, both quantity and quality of water. And so we already are seeing the impacts of that. We are seeing areas with a lot more erosion and downcutting of streams. We're seeing areas with a lot more high nutrients in the water and lots of invasive species coming in. So we already know what that means, and losing more wetlands would make that worse. I will say the rate of wetland loss in Wisconsin is really small now compared to what it was historically. And that's why we also spend a lot of our time talking about restoring wetlands, putting back some of that half of our wetlands that were removed mostly by agriculture and development. We need agriculture, we need communities and cities, but we also need wetlands. And so we need to find that balance and the place where we can restore wetlands to bring back some of the, address some of the challenges that have come up because we lost our wetlands.
One of the stories that I keep seeing crop up is about flooding in Wisconsin and how we are seeing the sorts of 100-year floods happen more frequently than every 100 years. And I wonder what the connection might be between that and our wetlands in the state.
Really great connection, really, really important connection. And yes, you're right, these huge floods are coming. They're bigger because of climate change, and we can't stop that. I mean, there's things we can do, but that's a whole other conversation.
We could.
I mean, there are certain impacts that are already upon us. And so we also then have to look and see what can we do to manage the fact that these huge storms are coming and all this flooding is happening. And we are doing a lot of work, particularly up in the Lake Superior Basin, although the work we're doing, we're designing so that it can be exported anywhere in the state, is really looking at assessing watersheds to find where wetland loss has occurred and where wetland restoration could be strategically done in order to have the greatest impact downstream, putting wetlands back on the landscape to be there to absorb more of the water when it falls so that the plug that comes down after a big storm gets spread out over time rather than coming in all at once.
Yes, we take a look at wetlands loss in Wisconsin. You talk about wetlands restoration in Wisconsin. Is there any impetus for wetlands creation? Can we just create wetlands, or is it once they're gone, they're pretty much gone?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Wetlands develop in places where the conditions are right for it, where nature needs a water management system. And so we can restore wetlands. We can restore areas of land that used to be wetlands and then were drained or something else happened, and we want to restore them there. Mother Nature put them there to begin with, so we know it's a good place for a wetland to be restored to. Creating wetlands in a place where they didn't exist historically is a little more problematic. There are times when it's really important because it's going to accomplish a very specific goal. But in general, we advocate for looking at where wetlands used to be historically and doing the restoration there, because the conditions were already right there at a certain time because Mother Nature created them there.
Let's get to your questions next with our guest, Katie Belfis from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. Ann in Manitowoc, we'll go to you next. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Katie, for all your information. And my question is about the ash tree die-offs. It seems that so many ash trees are bordering on wetlands, and just if you have a comment about the dying ash trees, how that will impact the wetlands, and if there's anything that can be done by people who have property on wetlands that are going to try and replace some trees. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Anna. Appreciate the questions. Katie?
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Ann. And ash tree die-offs are really unfortunate, right? This is primarily driven by emerald ash borer, which is an insect that comes in and sickens the trees, and the trees die over time. And it is, many ash trees do grow in wetlands and have some pretty significant cultural uses as well. So it's not only an ecological challenge, it's also a cultural challenge as well. But that is still to be determined. People all over the state are trying to figure out what to do and how to replace those trees with something other than ash, partly because the wetlands function differently when there's trees that can uptake and process all that water. You end up with a lot more water generally in areas that used to have trees when the trees are dead, and that's problematic. But you also have habitat shifts and changes. That is a still to be determined thing. There are many other wetland tree species that you can consider as a landowner, planting in an area where you have lost, where you've lost your ash. And I think we always like to stress a three-step approach for any landowner. Learning what your wetland used to look like and how it used to function historically, understanding the changes that have happened in the landscape around you, both within and around and up, especially upstream of where your property is, and then how you can try to get some of the processes back that were there historically that were messed up by the changes in a modern context. You're not going to get rid of the road that changed, you know, how the water flow through your system, now goes through a culvert. You can't get rid of the road, but how can you help the hydrology there? So really understanding it historically and trying to get the processes back that were in existence then.
Katie Belfis, our guest, and it is American Wetlands Month in May, and Katie's the Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. What questions do you have about the wetlands near you? Join us at 1-800-642-1234 or talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and this is The Larry Mueller Show. Coming up tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, consumer protection, taking a look at the latest scams making their way across Wisconsin with Michael Domke and Michelle Reinen from the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, otherwise known as DATCAP. And we'll also find out how we can best separate facts from misinformation. We'll talk to an associate professor of the media from UW-Eau Claire about how we can figure out what is actually happening and what folks want us to think is happening. That's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show from 11 to 1. But right now, our guest, Katie Belfus, Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. And Katie, there is a series of new videos that are highlighting the wetland and watershed conservation work of our Wisconsin tribes. Tell us about this series.
Yeah, this has been such a fun project to work on over the last few years. We understand, our executive director here at the Wetlands Association has worked with tribes for his entire career and knows that they have seen how they've been leaders in conservation in other parts of the country and wanted to see the same thing here. It's happening, but people don't know the stories mm-hmm. because the tribes are small, the reservations are small. So we started a couple of years ago collaborating with them to produce short videos. We're talking about 3 to 6 minutes long, very short, nice videos that just talk about the work that they're doing, whether it's restoration, as was the case with the Oneida Nation, or if it's protection and looking at the watershed health, as was the case with the Red Cliff up on Lake Superior. And the most recent, the latest release was from the Lac-Couturier tribe, which is in the Hayward area near the Chippewa flowage. And it's the story of their tribe in that area and what happened when the Chippewa flowage was created and then what they're doing in order to recover from that 100-year-ago event that was destructive to their rice beds in particular. So it's a great story of resilience. All of these are great stories of resilience and of the great work that tribes are doing in Wisconsin. So check those out.
What can we learn from our native tribes and their connection to our wetlands in Wisconsin?
I think the core thing that I think we can learn from tribes is that wetland conservation and watershed conservation is not sort of frosting, right? It's core. It's core to the health of our communities. It's core to the health of our human communities and our natural communities. And that we are part of those. Our health is determined and is linked to the health of our natural systems. So we can only maintain our own health and longevity if we take care of the world around us.
We're only as healthy as our wetlands.
Yeah, amen.
Where can we find these videos, Katie?
We have them on our website, wisconsinwetlands.org, or also on our Facebook page. If you look up Wisconsin Wetlands Association, you'll be able to find those out there.
And you'll also get details about tomorrow night's event at the Delta Beer Lab in Madison from 4 to 7, where you can raise a pint for wetlands. And if you miss any of that, you can always go to WPR.org/Larry after the show and get details. Karen wanted to know if programs to restore wetlands lost to farms have been successful in Wisconsin. Katie?
They have been, and there are programs in Wisconsin. Again, though, these are federal programs that may or may not be losing their funding. We are still waiting to find out. But where they provide some support for landowners who have land that was formerly in agriculture that was wetlands before that they would like to take out of agriculture and restore to wetlands for, you know, as we said, watershed quality and habitat. So those questions have been successful. The one challenge with those is that, of course, they depend on a willing landowner. And so they end up being sort of postage stampy, if you'll allow me the analogy, a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there. And that's good. But to be most effective, we need to be very strategic in where we're doing our wetland restoration and working with watersheds and groups of landowners rather than an individual here, an individual there. We should do that. And we need to be doing this more strategic approach as well that gets landowners working together for the health of their watershed.
What got you so passionate about wetlands in Wisconsin?
I had a family that spent a lot of time outdoors when I was young and some high school teachers that were very passionate about mm-hmm. conservation and about nature, and it just stuck right with me. I love being outside, and wetlands are beautiful and ever-changing and dynamic and never boring. So it's a really fun It's a hard job because a lot of people think wetlands are just mosquito laden swamp. But I consider it a personal goal in my life to help bring folks around and see that wetlands are in fact treasures that we need to protect, restore, and care for.
Like, you have to constantly find yourself making that argument for something that should be obvious if you're always around or outside in those elements.
That's exactly right. And honestly, a lot of folks just haven't really thought about it before.
Right.
And if, like, I have an ongoing joke when people say, oh, I'm really swamped, or gosh, I'm bogged down. I say, oh, no. Oh, you need a different vernacular for that, because those are all phrases in our language that are derogatory about wetlands and sort of reflect our historic understanding of wetlands. So next time you catch yourself saying swamped, you might say paved over or something else like that. Because we all get overwhelmed, so we need to have terminology, but let's not take it out on our wetlands.
Wow, a new idiom for us from our guest, Katie Belfus from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Thank you. As a lover of language, I thank you for that very much. We have taken a look at some of the questions about federal funding for wetlands preservation, but in late March, Governor Tony Evers announced that flood-prone communities could share in about $2 million in grants. The Pre-Disaster Flood Resilience Grant Program, what's it designed to do, Katie?
Yeah, this was such a wonderful thing that happened, and our organization worked really hard to help it happen. We were a champion and worked collaboratively with our legislators to put this together. As we talked about early in the program, we've got communities across Wisconsin challenged with flooding, and we want to help them assess their watersheds, figure out where wetland restoration and stream restoration can help them, and then help them deploy these projects that can help solve these problems. So this was the first round of funding. It's Governor Evers has put it in his budget, his next biennium budget, so that to continue the program, they got twice the number of applications that they could afford to fund. So there's clearly a demand, and we're very excited to see this continue.
So this could just be the start, and there were $2 million, but how many communities will receive this money if it goes through the budget?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question, and my colleague would know that perfectly, and I don't.
That.
I'm so sorry.
I apologize.
There's a nice link on our website that will give you the details, and the Wisconsin Emergency Management is the agency that's implementing this, and they'll have all the details about which communities were funded, which communities are doing it for assessment purposes, and which are doing it for implementation purposes.
But it does not appear as though this $2 million, were it to go through the budget, would meet the need in Wisconsin.
Correct. Yeah. I think we have a longer term need, and it's wonderful that it's a growing program. Somebody can assess 1 year and implement another year so that we can actually start seeing change on the landscape.
The Wisconsin Wetlands Association also has wetland coffee break webinars. Again, your waiter is not required, Katie.
That's right. You can do these from the comfort of your own home or even your couch if you want to there. We started this during the pandemic because we all needed ways to stay connected and keep learning about wetlands while we were stuck inside. And they were so popular, we've kept them going. So they happen about every week, and we invite speakers on a variety of topics. They all have to have a wetland connection, but it could be about soils or community types or turtles or insects. We've had all kinds of folks on talking about different wetland-related issues. We record them all. You can attend them live, or you can circle back and watch the recording. And we have all of those recordings available on our website. If you just navigate to the Wetland Coffee Break page at wisconsinwetlands.org, you can find a list of all the back programs. It's more than 100 episodes. So they're available to everybody. And we have an index, so you can sort of look through the titles and figure out which talks you are interested in and take a peek.
WisconsinWetlands.org. Katie, you got a favorite?
Oh, my gosh. That's really hard. There's some great ones on dragonflies and turtles. There's a lot of great ones for private landowners on caring for their property and managing invasive species. So there's really something for everyone. Sometimes they're more lighthearted and sometimes they're more serious. So pick and choose what works for you.
Yeah. And when's the next one?
The next one is I think next week.
Oh,
I got to get ready. We've got two beaver ones coming right up, which I'm very excited about because people always like knowing about beaver. Yeah, next week, May 30th, we have Courtney Dean, who's a graduate student here in Wisconsin and won the student presentation competition at our Wetland Science Conference this year with a talk about her research on beaver. So come take a listen to that. It's about how beaver ponds improve bat habitat.
Oh, an interesting connection. And right? Connected all through our wetlands in Wisconsin. Katie Belfis, what a pleasure, and happy American Wetlands Month.
Same to you, Lee, and same to all the listeners out there. Thanks for loving wetlands, and go out and enjoy them. Get your feet wet.
You bet. Katie Belfis is Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. You don't need to get your feet wet tomorrow if you'd like to tip back a beer with them. They'll be celebrating from 4 to 7 in Madison at the Delta Beer Lab. And again, all their information can be found on their website, wisconsinwetlands.org. You can also go to our webpage at wpr.org/Larry for details and links. And also want to thank our entire team that make this show so much fun and so easy to sit in and fill in for Larry for the day. Producers Claire Neipert and Joel Patenaude, technical director extraordinaire Jeff Robbins, and of course, our executive producer who makes it all possible, Jill Nadeau. I'm Lee Rayburn sitting in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.